animals remained the featured attraction at another theme park, opened in San Diego in 1964. SeaWorld was the spawn of four fraternity brothers from UCLA, who originally intended to open an underwater restaurant and marine show. However, as construction began, it became evident that the aspiring entrepreneurs' vision far exceeded their budget. Instead, the partners settled on building a marine animal park, originally showcasing dolphins, sea lions, and two saltwater aquariums. The group's big break came in the form of a bad blind date. An adolescent female orca captured in Washington State's Puget Sound turned a cold shoulder to her male orca companion at a private Seattle aquarium. So the aquarium sold the finicky finned lass to SeaWorld, where she was trained to perform a series of crowd-pleasing tricks. Shamu became a sensation, making SeaWorld a major national attraction, so much so that when she passed away in 1971, a succession of other orcas inherited her name and were charged with carrying on her legacy. Spurred on by their success, SeaWorld moved to open additional locations, curiously first choosing a site near cold weather Cleveland in 1970, and then more tourist-friendly Orlando in 1973. While standing out in the baking Florida sun at his company's newest park, founding SeaWorld partner George Millay heard so many visitors mention how much they wished they could join the animals in the water that he began to seriously contemplate ways to make it happen. Taking inspiration from seasonal splash pads and other wet attractions around the country, Millay conceived his vision for the Wet n' Wild Water Park that debuted in 1977. Many would argue it wasn't America's first water park. Even nearby Disney beat Millay to the punch, opening its River Country Water Park area the year before. But Wet n' Wild took the concept to a whole new level, erecting an enormous standalone park at which guests could plunge into a giant wave pool and hurtle down dozens of winding water slides for a fixed admission fee. Millay himself would come to be known as the father of water parks. The success of Wet n' Wild unleashed a wave of copycats across the nation, giving rise to a new industry. Among the most notable early water parks were Schlitterbahn in New Braunfels, Texas, and Noah's Ark in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. Schlitterbahn is a German word meaning slippery road. The park developers chose the name as a nod to the area's roots as a settlement for German immigrants in the mid-19th century. Like the big amusement parks, the most prominent water parks became prime destinations for families looking for fun-packed getaways. By the start of the 1970s, America was a nation on the move, a trend made all the more possible by the continuing construction of Eisenhower's interstate highways. Families everywhere were hitting the road to explore their country. They were trekking to America's national parks, visiting its historic landmarks, rediscovering how the West was won, gathering to witness history being made, and seeking new thrills at a growing bounty of amusement parks and water parks. My parents had delayed joining these families on the road until their fourth and final child, me, was out of diapers, and at least a little less likely to turn a long drive to Florida into a short trip to hell. They had now waited long enough. It was time to get going. Chapter 4. Packed in like sardines. Join us, won't you? From where I sit, or rather from where I sat, typically the rear window ledge of one of my dad's Titanic Land Cruisers, or in the rear-facing cargo seat in one of our family station wagons, there was simply no better time to be out on the highways exploring America than during the 1970s. It was the last true decade of the family road trip, for reasons we'll discover later. And everything that played into those expeditions, the highways, the cars, the motels, the devices we used while traveling, even the food we picked up along the way, had had enough time to evolve to make those experiences truly worth remembering. It was just a happy coincidence, of course, that this remarkable era happened to mesh with my family's years traveling the country together. I could explain why the 70s were the best time to be roving around America, but the only way to appreciate it is to experience it all yourself. Perhaps you already did with your own family while growing up at the time. Maybe you were even the one driving or trying to keep a car full of young kids from starting a mutiny in the back seat. Or maybe it was your misfortune to have been born too late to know what it was like to experience a real family road trip. Regardless, I now invite you to come along and join me and my family on one of our trips. Or rather, several. After all, to understand how family road trips came to be and what made them so special, we've got a lot of ground to cover. And what better place to discuss it than out on the road? First, you'll want to know a bit more about whom you'll be traveling with, so some brief introductions are in order. Joining us in the rear seat compartment are my two brothers. My oldest brother, Mark, was, and amazingly still is, a full 8 years my senior, a gap wide enough in kid world to make us more like distant acquaintances. He liked dance clubs, disco music, and Saturday Night Fever. I liked baseball G.I. Joes, the classic foot-tall ones with fuzzy heads and beards and cool adventure team vehicles, and the Herbie the Love Bug movies. Probably the most important time we spent together was on our family vacations. On our other side is my second brother, Bruce, just 11 months younger than Mark. My parents evidently thought they were working under a deadline. Bruce was nearly Mark's complete opposite. A gearhead, rebellious, loved muscle cars and loud rock. But unlike Mark, Bruce relished spending time with me, most often in one-sided wrestling matches in our family room, ending with me face down in a full Nelson and at least two lamps knocked over. Out on the road, Bruce's mechanical skills would save our bacon more than once. Up front, my sister Leslie would settle into the awkward middle space between my parents. In most of our cars, it wasn't even really a seat at all, but a sort of semi-padded fault line dividing the huge driver's seat and passenger seat. Still, it was her only refuge from the horrors taking place behind her. Pretty, petite, and blonde, Leslie is 5 years older than I, making me the baby of the family by a suspicious margin. Years later, my mom gently conceded I'd been an extra special blessing. A straight-A student beloved by teachers and active in every school activity, from key club to the yearbook committee, Leslie was the type of older sister that a slightly mischievous younger brother like me should have grown up hating reflexively. But she was also so inexplicably nice and generous to me that I found it impossible to dislike her. Finally, you'll need to meet my parents. My mother, Marilyn, was, as most young boys see their moms, perfect, beautiful, kind, playful, and eternally patient. If Dad was the engine of our family plowing us through any obstacle, Mom was the power steering, always keeping us headed in the right direction. In addition to raising four very different, but all strong-willed children, making our meals and managing our household, she also worked as a physical therapist at a local hospital. She was amazing. Which brings us to my father, Charles, or Chuck, as my mom and all of his friends called him. My father was a force of nature. An only child born to humble laborers on Chicago's South Side, my father proved his smarts and work ethic, first to his superior officers in the Army during World War II, for which he was promoted at just 19 years old to the rank of Master Sergeant, and later to his bosses at the local branch of a large national electronics distribution company. He was a natural salesman. And his gift for gab and unwillingness to take no for an answer had served him well. By the 1970s, he was the leading salesman and vice president at his branch, earning enough to move our family to one of the nicer suburbs of Milwaukee and provide us with all the trappings of an upper-middle-class lifestyle. In stature, my father stood exactly 6 feet tall and was of average build, belying his oversized personality and presence. He had a head of thinning, extremely blonde hair, accentuated by gold-rimmed glasses, and a round face that folded into deep crevices when he grinned, to reveal a wide set of bright white teeth. My friends all thought he looked like Conrad Bain, the actor who played Mr. Drummond on TV's Different Strokes, starring the precocious Gary Coleman. My dad was modest and conservative in nearly every way. except when it came to his cars. In this area, his tastes can most generously be described as endearingly eccentric. Owning full-size luxury automobiles, endowed with every fancy trim package and optional extra feature, was one of the few indulgences he allowed himself. Part of the reason was what he did for a living. The customers he sold his firm's products to included high-level executives at some of Milwaukee's biggest manufacturing companies. To build relationships with them, he knew he had to swim in the same social circles and, at least, appear to live life on their level. So he talked his boss into paying for his admission to a local country club to which many of these men belonged, and he bought a succession of fancy cars to drive there. That he also passionately adored every leather-upholstered, chrome-trimmed, gas-guzzling inch of these luxury cars was just icing on the cake. The truth is, my dad may have loved his cars a little too much. When it came to selecting optional trim packages, styling accessories, and color combinations, he could go a little overboard. In an era when automobile designers already pushed the limits of good taste, my father was all too willing to nudge them just a little further. He loved white wall tires and sparkling chrome wheels. He insisted on pinstripes. The more lines, the better. He adored monument-sized hood ornaments and glimmering side trim. He considered features like carriage tops and burled wood dashboards standard equipment. As a result, one of the two cars my family owned at any given time often resembled the perp vehicle being chased down on the latest episode of Starsky and Hutch. Now that you know who you'll be traveling with, I should probably tell you where we traveled and why. After all, you can't really experience a family road trip unless you feel like one of the family. Throughout the 1970s and into the mid-1980s, my family took two and sometimes three long road trips each year. Nothing kept us off the road. Not the oil embargo of the early 1970s, or the economic recession of the late 1970s, or even the disco music my oldest brother and sister would insist on playing on our car stereo. We had places to go, things to see, and almost invariably, a tea time to make at some sunny golf course at the end of the highway. This was because my father was fanatically devoted to the sport. Dad had an interest in golf the same way teenage boys have an interest in swimsuit models. Outside of his family, golf was his consuming passion. It filled his thoughts and his time as much as any hobby could for a man who wanted to remain happily married and gainfully employed. Typically, my dad played three times a week at the local country club, Thursday afternoons, Saturday mornings, and Sunday afternoons. If he could talk a client into a business meeting, he might even fit a fourth round into the week. My parents had actually met while on a golf junket. Well, my father was on a golf junket. My mother was simply vacationing at the same resort with a friend. For my dad, meeting a pretty, vivacious, and intelligent brunette just a 5-iron from the 18th green must have seemed like destiny. They were married 6 months later. Though my mom had never set foot on a golf course before, my dad had coached her well enough to join him in a couples league their first summer together. As for us four kids, Dad made sure we took golf lessons, whether we wanted to or not, as soon as each of us was old enough to hold a club. My brothers eventually rebelled as teenagers and found their own interests, but my sister and I stuck with the sport long enough to keep playing through high school. That was good enough for my dad. Between my mom, sister, and me, he had his little foursome and an excuse for turning our family vacations into his version of the PGA Tour. My dad's addiction to golf didn't just dictate where we traveled, but also when. If he didn't get his fix of fairways every few months, he'd begin to exhibit withdrawal symptoms. It made my parents' choice to live in Wisconsin an unfortunate one. For approximately 11 months of the year, or so it seemed, Wisconsin was buried in a thick blanket of snow, which presents a challenge for golfers hoping to locate a small white ball. To eliminate that problem and, as Dad put it, keep the shakes at bay, he planned our vacations for the winter months, while just about every other family I knew traveled during the summer. So that we wouldn't miss much school, Christmas and Easter breaks were earmarked for our getaways. Almost invariably, we traveled due south. It was the most direct route from where we lived to golf courses that didn't need to be plowed before they could be played. While most families selected vacation destinations based on their historical interest or striking natural beauty, ours were most often selected for their proximity to a well-maintained golf course with reasonably priced greens fees. If there also happened to be a beach within an hour's drive, it was mostly a happy accident. Of course, my mom still held veto power over the final selection, and she wouldn't hesitate in using it if there was nothing of interest in the choice for her. She may have allowed Dad to turn her into a golfer, but she wasn't about to let him turn her into a golf widow. While she genuinely enjoyed playing an occasional round of golf, she wasn't fanatical about it in the way my father was. She realized there existed a world out there beyond the white boundary stakes of a golf course, and she wanted to share that world with her family. So any destination my father ultimately chose would have to offer something beyond a favorably reviewed golf course. Most often, our destination would be a golf resort somewhere near the Gulf Coast, the same type of resort where my folks originally met, and, just as important, the kind offering deep discounts and ads in the back of Golf Magazine. To be honest, these resorts were a sensible compromise. The properties my dad chose were essentially glorified country clubs. Typically, there'd be a championship-caliber golf course, or two, or even three, to allow Dad to satisfy his lust for the links, in addition to a collection of other activities and facilities for the rest of us. Tennis courts, swimming pools, fishing holes, sometimes even horse stables or yacht clubs. To secure my mom's approval, he'd always select resorts near New Orleans or the beaches of the Florida Panhandle and take a break from golfing for a day or two to join us for a side trip. It wasn't the worst fate for my siblings and me to serve as my dad's personal golf gallery on family vacations. In fact, we had it pretty good. At least once we arrived at our resort, we were free to wander off and do our own things. Not all of my friends were so lucky. Some of my buddies spent their vacations being dragged to dreary museums, unimpressive landmarks, and second-tier Civil War battlefields, or they'd loiter for days on end at rinky-dink campgrounds where the highlight of the trip might be raccoons coming to raid the family cooler. One of my friend's dad insisted on stopping to read every historical marker they encountered, adding hours to each journey. Another buddy told me that on a journey from the family's home in New York across the country to the Grand Canyon, his father insisted on spending the better part of a day at a site called the Grotto of the Redemption in West Bend, Iowa. There, the family was treated to a tour guide's detailed dissertation on how a priest created 9 tacky scenes from the life of Jesus, using an assortment of biodiesel-fueled machines and a vast collection of semi-precious stones. Thrilling. Another friend told me of the cheers he and his siblings let loose as they finally crossed the state line into sunny Florida. After being cooped up together in a car for 2.5 days, they were eager to finally spend a day frolicking on the beach. Instead, upon seeing a billboard, my friend's dad impulsively pulled over in St. Augustine to tour the home of Prince Achille Murat, the son of the brother-in-law of Napoleon. I'll say that again. The home of the son of the brother-in-law of Napoleon. Yet another friend went on a family road trip in which there was no destination. He and the other 5 members of his family embarked on a giant loop of the American West, proceeding from one scenic mountain range, canyon, or landmark to the next, covering 5,500 miles over 17 days, never remaining in any one place more than a night or two. They saw some amazing scenery, but 17 days? In a car? With family? That would drive anyone to the brink. At least my family traveled in style, however garish and gaudy that style may have been. Even with 6 occupants, my dad's cars were relatively roomy. We had plush seating and, thanks to my father's penchant for loading his automobiles with extras, heat, air conditioning, a hi-fi stereo, and other amenities. Few of my friends could say the same. Many endured endless, nausea-inducing hours facing backward, perched on the thinly padded pop-up jump seats in the way back of their family's station wagons. One friend, whose father was an avid outdoorsman, has shared horror stories of being forced to ride for hours in the cap-enclosed bed of the family's pickup truck, en route to their distant cabin. While her parents traveled in relative comfort in the cab up front, she and her sister were tossed about in a dim, poorly ventilated compartment crammed with constantly shifting suitcases, tackle boxes, fishing poles, and even the family dog. In those days, this arrangement wasn't illegal. And in the Midwest, where dads who hunt and fish abound, it was likely common. What's more, my family could at least count on having a place to stay once we reached our destination. Other families brought their accommodations along. By the 1970s, towed campers had been around for decades. Airstream had begun producing travel trailers as early as the 20s, and introduced its iconic Clipper in 1936. But not all manufacturers were so adept in their engineering. One friend has described how his family's camper had a propane-fueled heater that supplied its heat through a register located in the middle of the floor. The grate covering the register actually glowed red with heat in the darkened trailer. My friend claims he still bears waffle marks on his feet from inadvertently stepping on the grate one night while answering nature's call. Another person I interviewed for this book related how his father deplored spending money on motel rooms, so he simply pitched a tent at night for the family to sleep in. The tent this dad purchased was a dime store special that needed to be secured to an overhanging tree limb to remain standing. One night, as the family slept inside the canvas compartment, a fierce storm whipped up. Waking to a loud crack from above, the family members scrambled outside just as the limb fell, crushing the flimsy shelter. There was brief panic as the family noticed that my friend's youngest brother was missing. After failing to locate the child's body inside the flattened tent, the boy's father thought to check the family's car parked nearby. There he found the little guy sleeping soundly in the back seat. Having been frightened by the approaching thunder, the kid had wisely decided that the car was a far better option to spend the night. That night, my friend's family had gotten lucky. And all told, when it came to how and where my family traveled, so had we. Though I'm sure everyone who has fond memories of traveling America's highways with their families believes their way was best, I wouldn't trade our experiences for anything. I expect neither would you. But enough jib-jabbing. It's time to get going. Chapter 5. Smokies in the Bush. Dodging cops and stops on the interstates. My parents were well acquainted with the perils of the Chicago morning rush hour. My dad was born and raised in nearby Cicero. My mom had attended graduate school at Northwestern University. They knew why the Loop had really been given its name. The city's downtown business district, through which I-94 ran, was essentially a black hole. Drive anywhere near it at the wrong time of day, and you could be pulled into a traffic jam from which you might never escape. Unfortunately for us, because we always traveled south, we really had no other choice than to take our chances and head right into its dark eye. Sure, there was a beltway around the city, but experience had taught my father that the route added miles to the journey and was just as likely to become backed up by an accident or stalled vehicle. So I-94 through the heart of Chicago we went. While we couldn't take a different route, we could dodge the delays. The key to avoiding morning rush hour traffic was to beat it. This wasn't easy. We lived in Milwaukee, 2 hours north of Chicago. To get ahead of the city's morning commuters, we had to leave our house at an hour when even the donut bakers were still snoozing. But if we could clear Chicago by 6 a.m., we'd have clear sailing the rest of the day. It sounded easy in theory, but the execution was far more difficult. It was one thing to get the car packed for an early morning departure. It was another to get 4 kids, including 2 teenage boys, up and going at 3:30 a.m. Even my parents struggled to rouse themselves. Electric coffee makers were just finding their way into homes at the time, and one wouldn't find its way into ours until 1980. If my parents were going to get up and get us out the door before dawn's early light, it would have to be without caffeinated assistance. The morning march to our garage resembled something out of a George Romero zombie flick. Six half-dressed figures, eyes drawn, hair matted, mouths drooling, stumbling about in a comatose parade. Fortunately, only one of us had to be fully awake. My dad, who always took the first shift driving. The rest of us needed only to sleepwalk from one bedroom to another one on wheels. We might as well have carried our beds with us. Before slogging off, we grabbed every pillow, blanket, and stuffed toy within reach so we could reassemble our sleeping quarters inside the car. We instinctively collapsed into our customary seating positions, three in front, three in back. My father, of course, was in the driver's seat, and my mom was in the front passenger seat. Leslie took the spot between them, where the large folding armrests made finding a comfortable position nearly impossible. For her, it was still preferable to getting mixed up in the chaos of the back seat, which my brothers and I would turn into something resembling an army barracks after taking a direct mortar hit. We'd mound pillows and comforters everywhere, and draped the windows with blankets to keep out sunlight. My brothers would bury their heads in pillows against opposite sides of the car, then spread their legs over the seat to claim as much space for themselves as possible. With no room left on the seat, I'd sprawl out across their laps, or crawl up on the rear window ledge. I actually preferred the ledge. It offered an agreeably flat, felt-covered platform on which I could comfortably stretch out. And the sloped rear window above afforded me a spectacular view of the starry night sky. Of course, the whole arrangement was ludicrously dangerous. Neither my brothers nor I wore seatbelts. If my dad had to slam on the brakes, I would have been launched like a 60-pound log into the backs of the heads of my parents and sister in the front seat. My brothers wouldn't have fared much better. But this was the 70s. As ill-advised as our seating arrangement was, it was also quite comfortable and perfectly legal. In fact, I distinctly remember relaxing up on the ledge one afternoon as a patrol car passed by on the highway. I waved at the officer, and he simply tipped his broad-brimmed hat to return my greeting. Suffice it to say, it was a more carefree time. The drawback to departing so early was that I would often fall back asleep before we passed two intriguing landmarks between Milwaukee and Chicago. However, I knew both well from passing them on return trips during more wakeful hours. The first was the Mars Cheese Castle, an establishment whose unusual name and iconic roadside sign stirred wild, borderline delusional images in my youthful mind. I pictured little green men in shiny silver spacesuits rolling thick wheels of Swiss and cheddar around a magical kingdom. Or maybe the castle itself had even been carved from a mountain of Munster or Parmesan. For years, I begged my father to stop so I could see for myself what was surely a stately citadel of dairy delights. Finally, he gave in, to my eternal regret. The world-famous Mars Cheese Castle turned out to be little more than a cheap cinder block hut. There were no laser-toting aliens inside, only aisles of refrigerated cases crammed with blocks of cling-wrapped cheese and racks of even cheesier souvenirs. I was crushed. Of course, the rest of my family had known the truth of the Mars Cheese Castle all along. My dad stopped only to finally shut me up about it once and for all. The grandly named yet profoundly disappointing castle fell to a wrecking ball in 2011, when the adjacent interstate was widened to accommodate more lanes. It would rise again nearby and in a form more befitting its name. The new and improved Mars Cheese Castle boasts mighty turrets and even a stately drawbridge entrance. Still no Martians, as far as I know. The other landmark that drew our attention was a road sign that never failed to start my brothers and me snickering, though for different reasons. There was nothing special about the sign itself, just plain white letters on a brown board, the kind used for designating a state park or historic landmark. It was what the letters spelled out that made the sign extraordinary. Bong Recreation Area. If we were awake when we passed it, one of my brothers would point to the sign and exclaim, "Dad, there's our exit!" And the three of us would begin convulsing with laughter. I didn't really get why I was laughing, mind you, but my brothers found it hilarious, so I figured I would just go along. Whatever they assumed, the Bong Recreation Area was not the site of some ongoing stoner festival. It was a property managed by the Wisconsin State Park System. The parcel was named for U.S. Army Air Force's pilot, Richard Ira Dick Bong. More snickers, I know. Who hailed from a tiny town in northern Wisconsin. Dubbed the Ace of Aces, Bong rose to international fame for his remarkable record as a World War II combat pilot. To this day, Bong remains the highest-scoring pilot in the history of the U.S. Armed Forces, with more than 40 confirmed kills to his credit. The 4,500-acre plot that bears his name was originally slated to be an Air Force base, but the plan was later scrapped when facilities nearby were expanded. Instead, the area was converted into a wildlife preserve, today also used by mountain bikers, horseback riders, and ATV enthusiasts. However, like the man for which it is named, the Bong Recreation Area is noted for one remarkable distinction. The park's signs rank among the most frequently stolen road signs in the country. While my family didn't have to worry about authorities tracking us down for stolen road signs, we did have to keep a vigilant eye out for law enforcement. That's because my dad was always pushing to make good time, especially when he was trying to get through Chicago before the morning rush. In doing so, he may have occasionally pressed a little too enthusiastically on the accelerator pedal, putting us at odds with the highway patrol. My dad knew that to elude Johnny Law, we'd have to spot him before he spotted us. That meant we were all expected to help Dad stay on the lookout for any lurking patrol cars. Chicago is the city that first put speed limit enforcement on the radar, quite literally. The police radar speed gun was invented in nearby Decatur, Illinois, in 1954, though some credit an earlier device developed for the military by two Connecticut engineers. The man behind its development was Bryce K. Brown, a physicist who previously worked on the Manhattan Project. It didn't take long for law enforcement to put his device to use. Within a month of the gun's initial public demonstration, Chicago Patrol officer Leonard Baldy became the first lawman to ticket a driver for speeding based on the readout of a radar gun. Later, Baldy would atone for his deed by helping motorists get where they needed to go faster. After retiring from the force, he swapped his radar gun for a microphone and became a traffic reporter for WGN Radio. An affable and funny man, Baldy became one of the city's most popular on-air personalities. As Flying Officer Leonard Baldy, he served up witty takes on Chicago's constant traffic jams to lighten the mood of frustrated motorists. Unfortunately, Baldy's new career cost him his life. In 1960, the helicopter he was reporting from threw a rotor blade and crashed in a downtown railroad yard. He was just 32 years old. In 2006, the city of Chicago honored his memory by renaming a street Leonard Baldy Way. By the time my family came tearing down the interstates in the 70s, radar guns had been around for two decades. The devices were now being used to enforce a new and much lower highway speed limit, 55 miles per hour. Those of us who were around at the time will surely recall the highway safety campaign telling us that 55 saves lives. But the original goal of the reduced speed limit wasn't to save lives. It was to save gas. The lower speed limit was a response to the oil crisis of 1973. Early that year, Egypt and Syria, with the support of other Arab nations, attacked Israel on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. Israel went on full nuclear alert, readying its bombers and missiles for launch. As an Israeli ally, the United States offered additional military support. In retaliation, the Arab members of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, cut oil exports to the United States, and the prospect of a long-term oil shortage in America appeared to be a real possibility. President Nixon and Congress immediately examined ways to cut America's fuel use. Presented with research indicating lower highway speeds could significantly reduce gasoline consumption, Congress decided to act. As part of the Emergency Highway Energy Conservation Act, Congress passed the National Maximum Speed Law, setting the new maximum at a dawdling 55 miles per hour. It was intended to be a temporary emergency measure that Congress would lift when the crisis had passed. Of course, it wouldn't turn out that way. Technically, the federal government had no power to set such a limit. The states owned the highways within their borders and were free to determine speed limits as they saw fit. Most set a maximum limit of 70 miles per hour, though 10 western states, where highways were lightly traveled, allowed drivers to go faster. The government could, however, force the states to reduce speed limits another way. It made setting a speed limit of 55 miles per hour a condition for receiving millions of dollars in federal highway funds. Though most states opposed the new limit, none was willing to concede federal funding. So in 1974, motorists across America were forced to back their pedals off the metal. The 55-mile-per-hour speed limit quickly proved popular with no one. Before the ink on the new law was even dry, more than 100 truckers parked their rigs on I-80 in Pennsylvania to block traffic in protest. The Teamsters petitioned Congress for a separate 60-miles-per-hour limit for trucks, but were flatly denied. Once the law went into effect, motorist compliance was almost non-existent, despite a massive public relations campaign to rally support for the new limit, increased fines, and ticketing binges by law enforcement. In a study of highways in New York, 83% of motorists regularly exceeded the 55-mile-per-hour limit. A follow-up 5 years later indicated an increase to 95%. Out west, where states openly opposed the law, enforcement was lax and penalties negligible. In Arizona, Montana, and Idaho, drivers caught exceeding the 55-mile-per-hour limit, but not the previous limit those states had set, were handed tickets for a trifling $5 to $15. The official offense? Energy wasting. While there was much debate over how much the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit reduced fuel consumption, there seemed to be no question about its impact on another travel-related statistic, highway fatalities. In 1974, the first year of the new maximum speed limit, highway fatalities dropped 16%. As a result, when the United States resolved its differences with OPEC and the oil embargo was lifted, safety advocates argued the 55 miles per hour limit should remain. Supporters made the case that if it was possible to both save lives and conserve fuel by simply passing a piece of legislation, however unpopular, it was Congress's duty to act. In 1975, the temporary 55-mile-per-hour national speed limit was made permanent. Or rather, permanent-ish. As time passed, one study after another pointed to the same conclusion. The 55-miles-per-hour speed limit, intended to save lives and fuel, in reality accomplished neither. As doubts grew, Congress commissioned the National Academy of Sciences to study the matter. The panel reported that increasing the speed limit from 55 to 65 miles per hour would raise fuel consumption just 0.2%. Equally damning were studies examining why highway fatalities decreased following passage of the 55 miles per hour speed limit. The data indicated a different reason for the drop. Fewer people were dying on America's highways because fewer people were traveling them. The spike in gas prices during the oil embargo caused Americans to drastically cut back on driving, especially on weekends and holidays, when most fatalities occur. In some states, highway travel decreased 30%. Naturally, there was also a corresponding drop in crash-related deaths. There was simply no evidence to support the idea that 55 saves lives. By the early 1980s, support for the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit was running on fumes. Oil prices had returned to low levels, Safer car design and wider highways had helped reduce crash fatalities, and a growing body of research indicated that the only real effect of the 55 miles per hour speed limit was that it made drivers angry. By 1981, legislatures in 33 states debated ways to oppose the speed limit. In 1986, Nevada openly defied it, posting a 70 miles per hour speed limit sign on a stretch of I-80 until the federal government followed through on its threat to withdraw funding. But the tide had shifted. Under mounting pressure, Congress allowed states to raise the speed limit to 65 miles per hour on rural sections of the interstates. In 1995, it struck all federal speed limit laws, once again giving the states full authority to set their own speed limits. Sure, it was great the government got around to eliminating the national maximum speed limit in the 90s, but it was small consolation for my family. We took our road trips in the 70s and early 80s when the ludicrously leisurely 55 miles per hour limit was the law of the land. My dad never got over the exasperation of being legally required to plod along at speeds 15 to 20 miles per hour slower than he'd been allowed to drive just a few years earlier. For him, the 55 miles per hour speed limit was like a government-mandated traffic jam. The law left us two choices. We could slog along at a snail's pace, adding hours to our trip and reducing our precious time in the warm southern sunshine, or we could join the throngs of drivers willfully flouting the law and get to a golf course lickety-split. For my dad, it was an easy decision. Exceeding the speed limit, of course, was risky business. And the only thing that would infuriate my father more than wasting our vacation time inching along the interstates would be forking over $100 for a speeding ticket. To minimize our chances of getting caught, Dad employed a variety of strategies. First, he charged all of us kids with lookout duty. He didn't just tell us to keep an eye out for patrol cars, mind you. He assigned each of us a specific sector to monitor. My sister might be told to watch the right side of the highway, while my dad would keep his eyes on the left. One of my brothers would be told to scan for patrol cars attempting to sneak up from behind, and the other would be instructed to keep an eye to the sky for any police planes. One of my dad's favorite tactics was to slip between two cars cruising 15 or 20 miles per hour above the posted limit. His thinking was that any officer with a speed gun up ahead might get a read on the lead car, and any squad approaching from behind might be able to pace the rear car. But the guy in the middle would never get nabbed. Finally, Dad always drove in the right lane whenever possible, even if it meant constantly leapfrogging slower cars. His reasoning was that cops were more likely to look for speeders in the fast lane. Law-abiding drivers, as he pretended to be, kept to the right. To help drivers like my dad outwit the highway patrol, the 70s offered several helpful devices. The first was cruise control. Trademarked under the name Speedostat, cruise control was originally created in the 1940s. Speedostat's inventor, Ralph Teeter, would never be able to use his own device. A childhood accident had left him completely blind. Despite his disability, Teeter developed a passion for working with machinery and became a skilled mechanical engineer. He was inspired to begin work on the device after enduring a torturous ride in a car driven by his attorney, who had an annoying habit of speeding up and slowing down in pace with his speaking. By the time the two made it to their destination, Teeter was exasperated, queasy, and determined to make sure no other passenger would again have to suffer as he had. Or perhaps he just wanted to create a way to help drivers maintain a constant speed. Teeter's system used a solenoid to vary the engine's throttle in relation to changes in the rotation of the driveshaft. Eventually, Teeter sold his idea to Chrysler, who introduced Speedostat as an inexpensive option for buyers in 1958. But sales were modest until the 1970s, and the nation's first real fuel crisis. It was then that automakers realized they could market cruise control as a cheap fuel conservation device. By reducing fuel-sucking surges of acceleration during highway driving, cruise control cut down on gas use. At a time when motorists were experiencing sticker shock every time they pulled up to the pump, cruise control seemed a wise investment. What's more, as drivers like my dad began using cruise control, they realized the device offered another benefit. It helped avoid speeding tickets. As police became more relaxed about enforcing the 55 miles per hour speed limit, drivers realized they were unlikely to be stopped for traveling less than 10 miles per hour above the limit. Many highway drivers, my father included, simply set their cruise control at 64 miles per hour and crossed their fingers. At least in our experience, the strategy worked. Not every driver was so lucky. One unfortunate motorist was Dale Smith, who, while driving one day in Dayton, Ohio, got caught in what he felt was an unfair speed trap. Really, aren't they all? A research scientist for the Air Force and an electronics buff, Smith didn't just get mad, he got inventive. Working in his garage, Smith created a small electronic device that detected X-band radio signals, the kind that police radar guns used, at a greater distance than their functional range. He attached a light that flashed and an alarm that sounded every time such signals were detected. Finally, Smith added a coiled cord that could be plugged into a car's cigarette lighter to draw power. He called his invention the Fuzzbuster and founded a company, Electroalert, to manufacture the device in 1973. Almost immediately, the Fuzzbuster was flying off store shelves at a pace faster than its buyers drove their cars. Soon the small black box was appearing on seemingly every dashboard moving down the highway, except ours. I never quite understood my dad's reluctance to buy one. The cost wasn't prohibitive, even for a man as frugal as my father. A low-end Fuzzbuster retailed for less than the cost of two speeding tickets. We'd certainly get plenty of use out of the device, between the considerable amount of travel we did as a family and the many miles my father logged for work. But I'm not sure Dad could get past the stigma that came with it. In a way, plopping a Fuzzbuster up on your dash was like extending a big electronic middle finger to the police. It smacked of the post-hippie, anti-authority sentiment raging at the time, and my father wanted no part of it. After all, he was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican, a family man, an upstanding member of society. He didn't want to join the ranks of the longhairs and scofflaws, the wearers of fringed leather jackets. When it came to the ridiculous 55 miles per hour speed limit, he didn't mind breaking the law. He just didn't want others to know he was doing it. Other drivers had no such reservations. Fuzzbuster sales soared, spawning a $400 million industry by the mid-1980s. In 2010, Dale Smith's original Fuzzbuster was named one of Time Magazine's all-time 100 gadgets. My dad never bought a Fuzzbuster, but he did come into possession of the other wildly popular electronic device being used on American highways at the time, the CB radio. It's not that he was suddenly inspired to don a cowboy hat, grow a thick mustache, and begin calling out the locations of Smokies, as users of the devices called highway patrolmen on the lookout for speeders. He simply inherited the CB as a built-in feature in a used car he purchased. That car was a wonder to behold. A 1979 Lincoln Mark V Bill Blass edition. A car so lavishly endowed with preposterous options and audacious styling that it surely holds a place of honor in some far-flung auto museum. Our Mark V embodied all that was so wrong and so right about the ludicrous excess of the 1970s. In its appearance, the vehicle seemed built to the same specifications as a U.S. naval destroyer. The Mark V was the largest of Lincoln's Mark series. Weighing just under 5,000 pounds, the Mark V was powered by a 400 cubic inch V8 engine that delivered fuel mileage, if memory serves, of around 3 gallons per mile. Parked in our driveway, the car made our ranch-style home look like a dollhouse. The Lincoln's exterior was painted a deep midnight blue with sparkling metallic flecks. Along its broad sides ran 2 stark white pinstripes, matching the color of the roof, which was a marvel all its own. Called a Landau carriage top, the roof was wrapped in heavy vinyl that appeared to be stretched over a metal framework, creating the illusion of a fully functioning fold-down convertible top. It wasn't. Another faux-style element was the rounded hump in the middle rear of the trunk lid that appeared to house a spare tire. It actually served no purpose other than to display the designation Continental in inch-high chrome letters to drivers following behind. The Mark V's other embellishments included opera windows in the roof, flip-up headlight covers, turbine-style chrome wheels, a slatted front grille, and a gleaming chrome hood ornament. Fans of the TV show Dallas may recall that Jacques Ewing drove a similar vehicle. Upon opening either of the car's two doors, yes, it was a coupe. Countless other opulent details could be glimpsed. Upholstered door panels, a burled wood dashboard and accents, dual padded armrests, and leather hand straps for rear passengers, essential for anyone hoping to extricate themselves from the rear seat compartment over the massive folding front seats. Finally, your eyes would come to rest on a collection of buttons, switches, and displays nestled in the center of the instrument panel. There rested the highest achievement in 1970s automotive entertainment technology, an AM-FM high-fidelity stereo with an 8-track tape deck and built-in 40-channel CB radio. Like cruise control, the CB wasn't invented in the 70s, but it became wildly popular during the decade. CB, short for Citizens Band, radio, actually dates back to the years following World War II. That was when the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, set aside a swath of radio frequencies that ordinary citizens could use to communicate with each other. Initially, CBs were popular with truckers and businesses with service staff, because they offered an easy and inexpensive way to exchange brief messages. As solid-state electronic technology became cheaper and more portable in the late 1960s, consumers began to purchase CBs for personal use. But it wasn't until passage of the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit that CBs really took off. Truckers used CBs to keep each other informed about law enforcement. And, during the oil crisis, the location of service stations that still had fuel. Before long, truckers got to know the sound of each other's voices, and conversations turned more congenial. Because many of their discussions concerned tactics for skirting the law, CB users adopted aliases to conceal their identities. These colorful nicknames or handles included monikers like Texas Pete, Old Spare, and Mama Flapjacks. Soon, ordinary motorists realized CBs offered many practical benefits as well. From having an easy way to call for help in an emergency, to being able to learn the whereabouts of patrol cars. Beyond that, tuning into CB chatter was just a fun way to pass the miles. In no time, CB ownership skyrocketed. Between 1973 and 1975, the number of CB license applications received by the FCC quadrupled to 1 million. By then, the CB was more than a communications device. It was a full-fledged phenomenon. Among those it inspired was William Dale Fries, Jr., an advertising creative director who, using an idea he'd originally developed for an ad campaign to sell bread, collaborated with songwriter Chip Davis to write the trucker-themed country song, Convoy. Fries employed the lively lingo of CBers to tell the story of a renegade trucker leading an outlaw convoy across America. Assuming the persona of a trucker named C.W. McCall, Fries rattled off his tall tale over a catchy guitar groove. "Well, we laid a strip for the Jersey Shore and prepared to cross the line. I could see the bridge was lined with bears, but I didn't have a doggone dime. I says, 'Pigpen, this here's rubber duck. We just ain't gonna pay no toll.' So we crashed the gate doing 98. I says, 'Let them truckers roll, 10-4. Convoy was an instant smash, reaching number one on American music charts and selling more than 2 million copies. The song even inspired a movie of the same name, starring Kris Kristofferson and Ally McGraw. CBs were featured in other movies as well, including three Smokey and the Bandit films starring Burt Reynolds and on TV shows such as The Dukes of Hazzard and Movin' On. Ironically, Although the unique language spoken by CBers was intended to disguise the meaning of their messages to law enforcement, CB lingo drew from those same sources. CB patter was an odd combination of police 10 code abbreviations, the phonetic alphabet the military used, Southern-flavored slang, and a nearly endless list of creative euphemisms. Colorful and witty, many of these terms and phrases quickly found their way into pop culture. Soon housewives and businessmen who'd never been near a semi were confirming plans with a 10-4 good buddy and bidding each other adieu with an enthusiastic keep on truckin'. Because CBers were often attempting to sidestep the law, many of the terms they used most pertained to the authorities. A patrol officer was a Smokey or a Bear. Both were references to the Smokey the Bear character used in public service campaigns to educate the public about the dangers of forest fires. Smokey wore a wide-brimmed hat similar to those worn by highway patrol officers. Depending on her attractiveness, a female officer might be a Honey Bear or a Miss Piggy, and sheriff's deputies were Cub Scouts. An officer in a construction zone was termed a Care Bear, and a cop scanning the highway with a radar gun was a bear taking pictures, or more colorfully, a hemorrhoid with a Polaroid. Officers who detected a speeder would turn on their disco lights or gumball machine and chase down a customer to deliver a paper hanger, after which the violating motorist would be required to feed the bear a hefty fine. Out on the super slab, multi-lane highway, a CBer might be trapped behind a slow-moving blinkin'-winkin', school bus, or anchor-clanker, boat trailer, trailed by a bumper sticker, tailgater, or nearly run off the road by a flyboy, a speeding motorist, in a fire chicken, Pontiac Thunderbird. Always on the lookout for seat covers, attractive female passengers, CBers also had to keep an eye on the road ahead for brake checks, traffic backups, lest one plow into a chicken choker, poultry truck, or pregnant roller skate, VW Beetle, requiring a meat wagon, ambulance, to be called. In the event of a window washer, heavy downpour, or to avoid the risk of ice-capating, slipping off the road in icy conditions, one might get on the horn to call out Breaker 19, a notice you were about to transmit a message on Channel 19, the channel frequently used by truckers to keep each other updated on Kojaks with Kodaks, to see if any good buddy, generally any other CB user, had his ears, CB radio, on, and could point you in the direction of a chew-and-spew, truck stop diner. There one could kick back and enjoy a suds and mud, beer and coffee, take a 10-100, potty break, or, if necessary, a 10-200. You get the picture. It was all very colorful and very popular for a time. By 1979, the number of licensed CB users in the United States totaled 14 million. Many more didn't bother to obtain licenses. Even former First Lady Betty Ford, using the handle First Mama, occasionally used a CB. So did Mel Blanc, the voice of Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and countless other Warner Brothers cartoon characters. Blank was known to frequently engage in conversations with other CB users in the Los Angeles area, especially kids, while in character. Given their popularity, perhaps it wasn't so ridiculous that my family also owned a CB. But there was still something patently absurd about a luxury automaker like Lincoln installing in its flagship model a device used mostly by slang-spouting redneck truckers just so a nice suburban middle-class family could break the law. Truth be told, our CB did serve a practical purpose. While my father was hardly the type to get on the horn and call out for a good buddy, he'd often keep his ears on and tune to Channel 19. There's no question these frequent call-outs helped us avoid having to feed the bear dozens of times. What's more, in a time long before cell phones, the CB provided some peace of mind for my mom. She knew that we could always use our CB to contact help in case of a breakdown, or in the far more likely event that my dad pushed his luck too far and we ran out of gas. Also, on more than one occasion, a passing CBer let us know that one of our rear tires looked dangerously flat, or that our trunk latch wasn't fully closed. However, one member of our family was determined to use our CB for a more meaningful purpose, to reach out and engage our fellow roadway roamers. That person was, of course, me. I may have been young, but I was confident in my mastery of CB lingo,